for argument, International Airport Center versus Citroen. Mr. Rubin.
Good morning.
This case presents a unique set of facts. We've looked all over and haven't found a fact pattern close to it. Because in the traditional manner of seeking what's called an advancement, the person seeking advancement, corporate officer, will go and seek the advancement almost immediately because of a need for funding to defend, and that gives an opportunity for the Delaware court, which does most of these apparently, to consider the matter on a clean slate. Here, what happened was, not only was there no attempt to seek advancement at the time that the case was filed in 2003, but as the brief for the appellee shows, in 2004 they asked for advancement from my client, and it was refused, and nothing was done. Indeed, nothing was done until after this court spoke in March of this year. And then they went into Delaware and sought advancement, which I humbly suggest is a misnomer. You don't advance after you've spent $1.3 million, and you're looking for indemnity, I would think, but that's a minor point. In any event, what the procedure in Delaware is, and there's no dispute, is they rule on the pleadings, and they've moved for summary judgment in Delaware. And so in clearly what's being asked of the Delaware court is to consider the very same pleadings that this court had before it and ruled upon. There's no difference. And in Delaware, and there's no dispute, you don't get advancement and you don't get indemnity if you're acting on your own. They call it personal rather than acting in corporate capacity. That is the exact ruling that was made by this court.
Well, we didn't. We just assumed the facts, though. We didn't make any findings. Let me ask you, but all these arguments you could make in Delaware, right? So,
well, that's always true. But I suggest to you very clearly that if you permit the Delaware court to, in effect, review this court's finding that those allegations, you're correct, you didn't make findings, but you ruled that that complaint, as pled, states a cause of action under the Federal Computer Act, and you ruled that those allegations permitted the federal court to have jurisdiction. Now, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to know what will happen if the Delaware court rules that there's an entitlement to advancement, and therefore they are holding, in effect, quite opposite of this court, that the allegations pled acting within the capacity of a corporate officer, which is what you ruled on. You ruled on the allegations that they pled that he was not.
Well, neither constitutes a merits holding. This court's opinion in the earlier case was a reversal of a 12B6 motion, which isn't a merits holding. And what the Delaware court is going to do, if it's permitted to, is not a merits holding either. It's a technical issue about the applicability of the advancement language in the corporate documents. And it's subject to a bond and reimbursement if it turns out that the fees aren't owing.
I disagree with Your Honor for this reason. The effect of the first opinion is that as the law of the case and the law between the parties, that those allegations plead a personal act. They do not plead a corporate act. The Delaware court and the bond and everything is just to secure. The Delaware court, before it gets to a bond or anything else, has to find that those allegations plead a corporate or color of corporate act. exactly the opposite of what was ruled and what had to be ruled here in order to find jurisdiction. And as Judge Flom said in his Wisconsin case, timing is everything. But
advancement wouldn't be worth much if the person who sued the employee could, by his pleadings, defeat the advancement.
No, that's not what I'm saying. You're absolutely right. And that's why traditionally they go in immediately. And then there's no ruling by a federal court, and there is no, as Judge Williams held in her California case, there is no federal order to be protected. And that is and had they done that, this issue would never have risen. But they waited until the very end, until after you ruled, and then they went in. When you have an order of this court, which is a res judicata, if you will, on those particular allegations that they do not charge a corporate act. And you get a real clue what they're up to when we've offered to go to Delaware. And they declined. We said all we want is to recognize the binding effect of this court's ruling on the allegations. That was refused. They said, what findings of fact? It's not to bind. You bind right now as to those allegations. No court in the country, except perhaps the Supreme Court of the United States, could declare that those allegations don't plead personal act. Now, that doesn't mean it's proved, but you cannot rule on those allegations contrary to this court, and that's what I'm asking you to protect. The ruling on the allegations.
Let me ask you a different question. So this $1 million, what security will you have that if Citroen loses the case here, this in the district court, you'll get your money back?
If Citroen loses this case here, he will not get advancement. Because
But suppose the Delaware court says he's entitled to advancement, then what security do you have to get the money back?
With all due respect, Your Honor, you're conjuring up an impossible fact pattern. Because if this court rules that
no, suppose you lose this case and you're stuck with Delaware, and they order you to advance this money. What security do you have to get it back?
His bond.
If they lose. There would be a bond?
His bond, for whatever that's worth.
He would be bond.
On the other hand, what concerns me is not the loss of the money so much. This case is 3 years old. As I say, it doesn't pay. You're not a rocket scientist to figure out what will happen. If they get that decision, they'll be back in the district court and be back here arguing that there's no jurisdiction, that this was not personal, it was under the color of his office, and therefore the Computer Act doesn't apply, and we'll be 3 more years and 2 more appeals up here, which is hardly a model of the orderly administration of justice.
On what basis could that argument be made?
Well, because argument that...
That the Delaware Chancery Court's determination trumps this court's
decision?
Well,
that's the argument being made now.
No.
Certainly they're saying that the allegations have to charge, they're moving for summary judgment, these allegations have to hold that this is not personal in order to get money in Delaware. They're actually doing what was criticized by Judge Williams. They're acting as a court reviewing this court's very decision. It's the same pleadings. And they come out exactly opposite of the way this court came out in the first appeal.
I assume you're going to argue, if the Delaware case goes forward, you're going to argue to the Delaware Chancery Court that it must respect this court's reversal of the 12B6 motion?
Well, I suppose an optimist is often wrong as a pessimist, but... I, from the transcript I've seen of the Delaware court, I think it's a foregone conclusion that there will be a ruling that this was not personal. And I think that this kind of situation, which is unique, and the courts have intervened when there's you protect a judgment or a ruling of this court, is exactly the kind of situation that was contemplated by the All Writs Act and by the exception to the Anti-Injunction Act. And I'll tell you, the case that's closest to it is what I call the Amalgamated Sugar case, which is the Second Circuit, and it's cited with great approval by Judge Flaum in his opinion in the agri-whatever case. And there was a judgment for the corporation in the district court, and then there was an attempt to have a stockholders sue in the state court. And this is no different, indeed, than what Judge Coffey held in the Winkler case. He said he reversed the Winkler injunction, and there it was much more modest. There was a question of a judge enjoining something involving discovery and protecting that order. And in the Winkler case, the only reason that Judge Coffey and this court reversed is because the judge didn't make proper findings. Well, of course, the judge made no findings here as well at all. And in the last analysis, I'm suggesting to you that if ever there was a case where there is likely to be mischief, because you'll have a state court and a federal court ultimately has to be in sharp disagreement as to the legal effect of those allegations. And one does not need a finding. I do not contend, and I never have contended, that this is a decision on the merits. Everybody knows what a 12b-6 is, but it is a decision on the legal effect or legal efficacy or the preclusion effect of the allegations that you ruled upon. And, for example, there is no ability of the Delaware court to hold that the Federal Computer Act was not pled to be violated in the complaint. That's about the same thing, because that's what's going to happen. Because unique here is that your findings of those allegations being charging personal act was jurisdictional to the federal court, which makes it necessary really to doubly protect it, because we're going to have an attack on jurisdiction. And as much as I like to come from California here to argue, I think we've had enough deja vu in this case. And I'm suggesting to you that you cannot hold, since you cannot hold in Delaware, you inevitably are having conflict between two courts. And what you've done is create a tension between this dual system of justice, state and federal. And Judge Posner is quite right. Had they gone in the first day or the second day, there would be no such issue. But they waited until after there was a decision in this court, and I sincerely believe, I'm not a mind reader, but I sincerely believe that what's going to happen is indicative of what happened so far in this case. These are very industrious, very bright, and very creative lawyers. And it took 3 years to get, 2.5 years to get up here and get a review of jurisdiction. And I think if we go back to the Delaware court, this case can be labeled as was in Macbeth, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps into this petty pace to the last syllable of recorded time. And so I'm suggesting that, and he's not harmed, because the judge below, although he eschewed that his ability, I think federal court can do it as well as the state court, he can get his money in the federal court if he's entitled to it. But the federal court is under your aegis. That's the difference.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Rubin. Mr. Marmer?
Good Good morning. May it please the Court. The Delaware proceedings present no threat whatsoever to this Court's jurisdiction or its rulings, because the questions that will be presented to the Delaware Court will have zero impact on the issues.
What will be the issues, or what are the issues that you've briefed in your summary judgment? Oh, you haven't filed your summary judgment motion, but what will be the issues in the Delaware
We did file it, and it's attached. It's in the record, Your Honor, and where it's located is in the appendix. You will find the briefing on the injunction proceedings below and an exhibit to our opposition brief in the injunction proceeding below includes both our complaint and our motion for summary judgment in Delaware. You can read those, and you will see we made no argument seeking to undercut or in any way be inconsistent with anything this Court is looking at. Now, let me answer the question Judge Posner directed to me. What's going to happen in Delaware? Delaware is going to, and I think the parties agree on this part, we'll look at the pleadings, we'll look at the actual operative provisions under which we're seeking advancement, and test those to see whether under Delaware law that's the kind of issue for which you get advancement or not. Now, there's a false equation that's lurking in what IAC has been arguing, and that false equation is that if you can plead an allegation which, if true, would mean you lose your agency status, then having pled such an allegation, you necessarily, for Delaware law advancement purposes, must be in the category of personal claims as to which no advancement is required. The Delaware courts have uniformly, absolutely, consistently rejected that analysis, and we have the case law in there. DeLuca, this is a case that they began by citing and saying it was good for them. It's a decision by Vice Chancellor Strine, who is the Vice Chancellor that has our case. If they really believe that the DeLuca decision supports their position, they should be delighted to be proceeding in front of Vice Chancellor Strine because he wrote it. But I think they, in their heart of hearts, may surmise that that decision really is the death knell for them, because what he says and what every the Chancellor and the Vice Chancellors consistently have held is that if you plead a breach of fiduciary duty claim in Delaware, sure, you can say, well, if these allegations are true, the person was a really rotten scoundrel. And if these allegations are true, that person was acting for his own benefit. He was stealing for the company, whatever the allegation happens to be. But at this advancement stage, we don't credit the allegation as true. We simply ask, is this the kind of fuss as to which your advancement provision is triggered? And they always hold that a breach of fiduciary duty claim will be covered. That's the point of it. And that's clearly in DeLuca. It's also in Reddy v. EDS, where this exact argument is described again by Vice Chancellor Strine, and it's held consistently throughout. In fact, I'm sorry, it looks like you're about to ask me a question. There is a decision by the Chandler, in a guilty plea case. It's just the facts are really quite compelling, and it's called Bergonzi. It's cited in our brief. And in Bergonzi, the company had been paying advancement. The former CFO pleads guilty in federal court to conspiracy to defraud the company, and as part of his guilty plea, he goes through the elocution, so he actually admits under oath his guilt, but he's not yet sentenced. The company then cuts off advancement. They go back into Delaware court to fight over whether advancement is to continue, and Delaware says no. Advancement continues because if you look at your agreement, it says you get advancement until there's a final disposition, and there's no final disposition until a sentence has been imposed and he's entitled to a lawyer through his sentencing. After we are done with advancement, once we have rulings on the merits, Delaware has an entirely different set of tests. It's now going to police the question under the law of indemnification, and indemnification rights will turn upon whether you really were a rotten scoundrel or not, and whether the kind of rotten scoundrel you're alleged to have been turned out to be the kind of thing for which indemnification is not available. But Delaware is absolutely clear on this. In advance, the whole point of advancement is to be sure that when you're under attack, when the company is accusing you of all of these awful things, you get your legal fees paid.
What's strange about it, I would have thought this advancement provision was intended for situations in which some customer, supplier, what have you, sues the individual, not where the company. It seems odd that the company should be financing the defense of a person who defrauded it or is alleged to have defrauded it.
You know, actually, the courts have dealt with this repeatedly. And the Delaware Chancellery Courts are absolutely crystal clear that that is not the case. In fact, what they presuppose is that it's when the company has turned on its own executive that the right to advance is most essential. Because in the normal case, where you have an outsider accusing it, you expect the company to stand behind you. And again, let me be clear. Under Delaware law, because there's often confusion on this point, Delaware law does not require advancement. Delaware law makes this discretionary with the company. So if you don't want advancement as a company, you don't specify it. There is no automatic advancement.
Yeah.
Now, Delaware says, however, we're going to, by statute, make it quite clear that if you opt into our advancement system, you're also the master of the circumstances. You can make it discretionary advancement with the board. You can make it compulsory advancement. You can require an undertaking. You can require the posting of bond.
What do you mean by our advancement system? Isn't it just contract? I mean, couldn't it be any state would enforce such a contract, wouldn't it?
A state certainly should. What's unique about Delaware is that the General Assembly has specifically addressed the issue of advancement by creating summary proceedings investing specific jurisdiction in the Delaware Chancery Court as part of its articulated policy favoring it. So, I mean, you have a sort of interplay back and forth, as you often do, between the legislature in Delaware is arguably uniquely responsive to the business legal issues, and so that's the unique feature. But your fundamental question is certainly correct, which is that this could be a charter under Illinois, and a state court ought to respect the contractual underpinnings of it. On the Anti-Injunction Act issue, just to mention...
Just before you get to that,
sure.
Mr. Rubin emphasized or made a big point of the fact that you're not really seeking advancement, you're seeking reimbursement. And why is the request for advancement so belated?
Answer to the first question is it is advancement because in advance of a determination on the merits, the issue is always advancement. And there are indeed Delaware cases there in our briefs where there has been
years. I'm not questioning the lawfulness of it.
You're asking the factual question,
yeah,
why did we wait so long?
Yeah.
Okay. The answer to that, it's relatively complicated, but I'll try and make it as brief as I can with my light on here. When you're deciding whether to open a second front of litigation, there's a lot of pros and cons to it. The pro, obviously, is that if you spend some money on advancement proceedings, you may get the rest of your bills paid. So that's the big carrot to go ahead and do it sooner. The con of it is you are defending in two different suits at the same time, and you have escalated the battle with your opponent. Now, a lot of this also has to do with what kinds of resources are available to you at the moment. There are some facts that are not in the record about when he got funding from his father-in-law and when he didn't. I mean, it's a fairly complicated mosaic. It is certainly true, as we say here, that when they refused to go into the Illinois State Court, basically, and decided they wanted to hang on to their federal claim, which they had every right to do and prosecute up here, but they were willing to take the delay on that. And it looked for all the world like if they didn't prevail in this court, they were going to go away. There was a serious question about what to do on that. When they went ahead and I understood why they did it on the timing they did to save their timeliness under the savings clause. So they go in. We said, okay, that the jig is up. They're going to come after us whether they win or lose. That means we're going to go into a whole second round of this. Okay, if we're going to have to pay for a full trial on the merits, time to get this going. And as we say, and I understand the evidence is, you know, this gets into more detail than anyone really wants to know, but retained the Delaware counsel to file the action before we got the court's decision. So, but there's just no possibility that the Delaware court is going to do anything that's going to interfere with this court's jurisdiction.
So there's no scenario under which the Delaware court's decision on the advancement action would have preclusive effect?
Inconceivable. Inconceivable. And beyond that, let me say, if we take a big picture and we look at the Anti-Injunction Act, I mean, Judge Williams wrote the Zurich case, you've got historical cases of enormous significance where the federal courts have looked at important and critical federal rights and nonetheless, in the face of the Anti-Injunction Act, said, you know, the normal rule is the same parties can proceed on the same case on simultaneous tracks. There will absolutely be the chance that they'll be inconsistent, and we let that happen. And even if it's a compulsory counterclaim, we let that happen. And we let the second court decide the impact of the first court's decision as a part of our federal system. But big picture, if we think about this, we are asking the question whether the federal court's ruling on what constitutes transmission under the Computer Fraud Act is somehow jeopardized and elevated to an exception from the Anti-Injunction Act because we fear that the Delaware Chancery Court, acting on an issue of advancement involving a Delaware company, is somehow going to be so hostile to the federal interest implicated that it will thwart both the jurisdiction and rulings. I mean, in Judge Williams' opinion in Zurich, Your Honor cites to Judge Wood's law review article on one of these issues, where Judge Wood has made the point that part of what you would expect to see in Anti-Injunction Act analysis is some demonstration of apparent hostility, that you would have a reason to believe that there really is some sort of immediate threat to the federal judiciary under one of the exceptions in a way that would call upon you to exercise this extraordinary affront to comity. That's absent here. It's absent because, to my knowledge, there has never been in the history of the Delaware Chancery Court some large and mounted campaign against the federal judiciary. And if you read the entire record, which we did not submit, but we're happy to do so, there is an embarrassingly gushy section by Vice Chancellor Strine about how much he admires Judge Posner and the Seventh Circuit. You know, that part got left out, right?
That's very comforting.
Yeah. I mean, he goes on to say, essentially, I'm not the Ten Commandments judge that's going to thwart federal authority. I mean, he has a very tongue-in-cheek approach, and unfortunately, if you're reading it and you don't get a sense of where he's kidding and where he's not, it can be laughable. But I don't think he was kidding about his nice comments about you, Judge Posner. But, you know, but when you ask this big question, can you really imagine a circumstance where we're going to say that we will, as the Supreme Court did, too bad about federal unions' rights to picket, all right, we still have to respect state court injunctions, too bad about the fact that the exact same parties are litigating exactly the same case, even though the state court action should be a compulsory counterclaim in the federal action, too bad about all that, because comity is essential. Because, as a constitutional matter and as a part of our history, the seating is such that we don't act. But here, by golly, having an advancement action ruled upon by the Delaware Chancery Court poses such a grave threat to our federal system that we're going to enjoin it. It's preposterous. There are cases, as Judge Williams' opinion in Zurich notes, the desegregation cases. That's pretty obvious. Okay, you can see why federal courts have to act there. We have another exception that's developing in terms of multi-district litigation. That's a situation. Judge Easterbrook has a decision involving a class certification set of issues. These are getting closer to the quasi in rem because they involve multiple parties in multiple courts. There's arguably a string of cases that I hesitate to say are Madison County exceptions, but one could argue are explained on that basis. All right, but, you know, we're talking about the Delaware Chancery Court here on advancement. And I say again, and these transcripts can be reproduced, I can be quoted if I ever walk away from this, it is inconceivable that any ruling by the Delaware Chancery Court here could in any way, shape, or form ever interfere with the jurisdictional holding that this court has made in the Seventh Circuit. And you can look at our opening brief, which is attached as an exhibit, and you will not find any such argument anywhere there.
I want to ask you a procedural question. I know IAC requested that there be a stay in the Delaware. Has the Delaware court responded to that?
Yes. What the Delaware judge, chancellor, said, they don't call themselves judge, vice chancellor said, was that he would not stay it because he felt that the briefing had to continue in either court. So it's sort of like when you have a motion to transfer and the defendant always says, oh, let's postpone discovery until we figure out what court we're in, and the district court judge says, I'm not going to have this case go to the new judge with nothing having happened on it. So he said, no, what we'll do is we'll rule it. They're probably going to rule quickly. Let me know. We'll set the briefing schedule. Their response is due this week. We said we can respond promptly. I think we have to notify him when we're done where this thing sits. But he was operating on the assumption that because we had, one of the things we said was we consented to an expedited appeal because we did not want to create any kind of procedural collision between the two judges, and it seemed to us likely that the Delaware Chancellor would want to at least give this court a chance to act first, and we didn't want to be the foot draggers that looked like, well, we're trying to get you to rule to moot it out, because we figured, first of all, that's not really attractive, and second, the Delaware Chancellor would probably take a really bad read on that. So I think he's expecting that there will be a prompt decision from this court, but he has not officially stated. But he's very sensitive, and I'm sure we'll all report back on where we stand.
So then he hasn't set a ruling date.
He's not set argument or a ruling date. He said, when it's all briefed, then tell me where you're at with the Seventh Circuit, and we'll start. He has not said that if And if we look at the rulings, I don't know if this is true in your Zurich ruling, but certainly in a number of the cases you'll see sometimes it says on these kinds of cases, ruling issued on this date, opinion issued on the other date, because it's an injunction question. So sometimes the courts will get the ruling out even if they want to take a little longer for the opinions.
Just a quick question before you sit down. What sort of an undertaking or bond do the corporate documents require?
They require an undertaking only, not a bond. And again, under Delaware law, they're the masters of what they require. So the Delaware courts enforce the contract. If you want an undertaking, that's what you specify. If you want a bond, that's what you specify. And so the Delaware court will consult what was specified in the agreement and will require us to meet it, which here is an undertaking.
Okay.
I'm out of time. If there's no further questions, I'll sit down. Okay,
thank you, Mr. Marmer. Mr. Rubin, it's about a minute or so.
I'll give you an additional report, Judge Williams. The request was that we stipulate that the briefs we file in Delaware be the briefs that be filed here. We've rejected that stipulation. In addition, if everything is as Mr. Marmer says, I don't understand why he didn't accept the suggestion. We offered to go to Delaware. All he had to do was stipulate that nothing would happen that would in any way impact on this court's ruling, and they rejected that. And they took the position that's before you in a footnote. You didn't make findings of fact, and so I don't know where that leads them, but they rejected that as not being bound, as not being bound by this court's ruling. There is no case in Delaware that they cite, including the two he discussed, where there was a prior ruling by a federal court. That's the difference. As I started this argument, that's the difference between this case and every other case, and I can't find a case where there was a prior ruling by a federal court where the court didn't enjoin. That doesn't stop him from coming here and getting his money. And finally, I suggest to you this story about they waited for the $1.3 million, and if we had gone away, they would have given us a pass. They wouldn't have asked for the $1.3 million. I don't believe in Santa Claus. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and there'll be a brief recess before the next case.
Everybody's got one, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're good.
This is Judge Abbott stuff, right?
I hope so.
Yeah, I bet it is. You gonna give me another pad?
Yeah. Just take this off. I don't know what you want to keep this note. You
know what? Put this with this note.